Well, I'm glad you came again. We got one more lesson. I will deal with an interesting part of the Bible, Genesis 14, called the Abrahamic War. I've been trying to relate events in the Bible, obviously, to the things we're studying, rather than just the things that study that have nothing to do with the Bible. So we'll do that next week, and then we'll off for the summer. And well, since I got you here, we are going to, Lord willing, do a trip in 22 to Israel, loosen the rules up so that you can at least make the travel. So if you have interest in that, it's probably about May 9 for about 2 weeks in there. So if you want to look at your calendar, I'm afraid we will go with the full group. So if you have interest, let us know. Let me know. The second thing about Israel, again, we're going to do a private tour in October. And the reason I'm telling you that is because I've been wondering what I should do in the fall. And well, that's my answer. We'll do what we did on the private tour for you on Wednesday night in spots we haven't been to before. So that kind of is a relief to me that we can have something I can think about for the fall. Anyway, that's what we're kind of doing. And I can explain things all the time, right? In fact, that's what lessons are. They explain things. And history explains things. So we're in a primitive time. We don't know actually how the rules function. We're talking from the flood to Abraham. We really don't know. We assume that they function like we do. Probably a mistake. So I kind of want to talk about the rules that they live by in our lesson today. So just kind of overall picture. So we finished our fourth of the five-week study on the post-diluvian world. There are some unresolved issues that plague the church age minds, all of us. It plagues our church age minds. That a clear enunciation of God's creation and redemption as we know him is strategically obscure. He is known by eight names, the El Shaddai's and El Nion and Yahweh. There's eight of them. But there is a lack of expected definition of him as a person and Lord of all. Also missing is clearly defined or enunciated faith of nearly all of these before diluvian eight, and even the post-diluvian seven additional children of Noah. It just doesn't say anything about that. It appears that they function as political entities without any acknowledgement of the will of God or making peace with him. Nothing talks about it. See, that's church age thinking. What we have, however, is a clear dedication and loyalty to Noah in the person of Shem, who personally conveys blessing, I believe the mantle, to the faithful and to the fully unlikely personage of Abraham. So we get from Noah to Abraham. That's basically what happens in this, then you get that out of the Bible. You'd have to do all the other stuff we're doing, but don't lose track of it. That's what's happening in this period. So we have a lineage of genealogy of Noah, or to Noah, but not of a faithful line. We sort of have to drop the idea there's a faithful line anywhere. You know, we just don't have that many in line. So we have Abraham's father was an idol worshiper. How can you call that a faithful line? So it was from Abraham on that we have a clear defined faith in the declaration, Genesis 15:6. And Abraham believed God, and to him it was credited for righteousness. To him is righteousness. Gave it to you. This is the new expression and continues the model of faith for our time. But it is notable because it was the first time of such declaration after 2,000 years. When it said, the Lord said to Noah, enter the ark and you and your whole household, you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time. Genesis 7:1. For the history of these 500 years, it certainly gives one the feeling of a secular world with the compulsion to populate it. You get that. This is the only clue that gives us a connection to the God of the Noahic mandate, Babylon, that's notwithstanding. So we know that's part of the mandate, and that's all we really see of what God told them to do, and that's what they're doing. Don't see much of else. We have these eight names of gods floating around with different groups, but it's almost like there are eight names of God that point upward, and no one knows that they're all connected to one God, it seems like. they weren't very smart. I'm sorry, not to say it that way, but they weren't really well informed. So they sort of had the divided idea of God, although they had right ideas about who God was because they used the right names for him. But they were identified by these names, by the linguistic groups. God was known by those different names. So roughly the time of Noah, the rebuilding of the population of the earth to the time of the last Noah's family is 1987. By the way, these are all BC days, of course. So it's about 500 years. It pretty well, you know, marks it off. 2518 to 1987 is the last of those what we call the Noahic family that dies off. Heber. Well, this period has coverage in the Bible, Genesis 9 and 10, plus other texts. It does not get detailed treatment of as Abraham's family. And we think about this virtually from Genesis 12 on, virtually all the rest of the Bible, except Job, is dedicated to Abraham's descendants. Now, think of the difference there is. So in my mind, we said there's something's happening here at Abraham. Obviously, some kind of change in plans or a clarification of plans has to account for this inequity. Now, we have interest in this period because no one else does. Kind of like, well, we do, I do, or so it seems. Therefore, the 500 years of history is largely unaccounted for, except we end up with Abraham's family. And that's how we basically teach it. There's nothing taught about these. There are four incidences that are important here. We have Noah's flood. Then we have Ham's curse. Then we have Tower of Babel. And then we have something that I have not been able to get my arms around or head around. And maybe we'll try it a little bit next week, is the great war that separated the world into two halves. And that is what is referred to in Peleg's time. The earth was divided. It was a war. That the population was divided. We have all kinds of ideas. Well, the earth slipped, you know, continents shifted over. And no, it was a war. And it was a division of people. But it's a very, very complicated war, how it's got set up. And that's why I haven't dealt with it much. But it is that obviously, like we said in the beginning, you start with Ham's sin, and it just divides the world from then on. So we have this. But surely there are other lessons and truths available besides just Abraham's family. And we should we continue to perpetuate ignorance or make an attempt at useful discoveries? So as the pioneers risked it all we can risk is our ignorance. Therefore, the task can be done well or poorly, but it must be done. And as I've thought about this, for me, this is still just the beginning of the study. And I hope that's not too scary for you. I got to keep working on this. There's more to it than I know. So remember, as a reminder, this is a challenging study since much of the literature from this period is considered mythological and mythical. It was popular to disclaim any legitimacy to the myths because not doing so gave credibility to the mythological Bible, they thought. While the evangelicals did not think the Bible was a myth, they did fall prey to long unknown periods of time before Abraham and even before Adam. Therefore, little helpful literature has been written for this period. However, John Pilkey began his work around 1962, finished at probably 2012, because he saw that there was more than made-up stories in these ancient accounts. With due diligence and 5 decades of research, comparing various accounts, an account that would approximate the truth has been extracted, and it's an approximation of the truth, it's not the scripture. The foundation of all of Pilkey's work is the biblical account as this rock-solid information. We don't equivocate at all on what the scripture says, which is the advantage we have from those that are secular anthropologists. They start with nothing and try to come up with something. We start with the Bible and can probably come up with something. So the Bible basically is the skeleton on which all the flesh can be hung. So the result is an amazing history of human intrigue, accomplishments, and disappointments. And I might say disappointments. The period has been named the dispensation of human government, or sometimes you just say government. And by the way, that dispensation continues on into our time because we still live under human government. So this is drawn from the simple statement in Genesis that honor and respect must be paid human life because it's made in the image of God. Therefore, government had the right to interfere. So the rule was in Genesis 9:5, if human blood is shed or the person dies as a result of a violent act, the guilty person must surrender his life as a punishment. You don't take it from him. He must surrender it. So the principle of human governing humans is a new characteristic of the dispensation. So we have 1,500 years of humanity living without human government. So they're living by squads and family and whatever you can muster force on others, you can survive. But there's no human government to interfere or help. So this will take on the character of authoritative kingship. And this will be over the regions and zones of the land, that the world is to be ruled by kings as appointed by the Noahic family. And remember, when Israel got unhappy with the way things were going under the judges, they wanted what? Kings. And so they're looking at this model for their government, a model that was new with Noah. Now, these are the records. This is how Genesis 10 goes. These are the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and more sons as daughters were born to them after the flood. In the names listed in Genesis 10, there are 54 individuals. I was going to bring in and show you my. If you take your Bible, take your Bible and go to chapter 10, you see all the names listed, and you've seen charts of these names listed out. That's what I'm going to show you. Well, if you count them all, I did it real quick and I could have been off. I got right at 70. I said 78. I think it was 70. Something like 70. You can count them. 70 names, but actually there are only 54 individuals in that list because some of the names are duplicated. Because some of the names aren't names. They're really, events or places or, whatever. So that's what we have in 10. And so the genealogy really isn't a genealogy as we think about it. It's more like a political landscape that is not necessarily limited to father and sons. Did I miss something back up here? Yes, I did. See, the records of is from the word, Hebrew word, toldot, or sometimes put H on toldoth. So we need to understand that this need not be a father-son generational record, but significant persons who line up in this manner, sometimes politically, and that's how it's presented. But we wouldn't know that unless we had some outside information about it, which has been lost. So we have the names of the list in Genesis 10, The genealogy is more like a political landscape, right? The wives on the ark are thus included as sons of Token, and they're named there. Sheba, Ophir, Jobab, and Havilah in Genesis 10, 28, 29. They're last on the list. I might give you some angst here. I don't know. I don't want to do that for you. So I'm just telling you, these genealogies aren't just like genealogies like we think about it, because the Bible doesn't say the genealogy. So these are the records of, and then it's of these families or these people. So we make the assumption that's not necessarily. There were 7 first-generation children after the 8, bringing the entire family of the 8 Diluvian plus 7 post-Diluvian children, totaling 15. The 7 children were born and grew to maturity. I'm assuming we had 30 years before the first expedition occurred, because these children will get land grants or zones marked off for them. And it seems like it would be probably more likely that they grew up a little bit before they gave them baby something in the mages. Now, this is your deal, right, dearie, honey. No, these are probably grown up people. We got 30 years for it to be done. And we have 4 women through which these 50 people are going to be born. So plenty of time for this to be done. So the individuals are assigned their own settlement zones by the end of the 180 years after the flood. So you have 30 plus 50 years. Now, here's where we have to be a little bit careful and just kind of reserve your discomfort about all of this, because we'll talk about what we call incest. We call it incest. I don't think it was called then, but we have different people show up here. And on the left, you say, you have all these children that are born to these people are fathered by Noah. All right. He has 2 sons, Japheth and Ham and Shem. And then we have the wives listed here. And then we have the children. Now, this is probably too hard for you to see. But we have the seven children. The pink were listed for the ladies, and the blue is listed for the boys. So there's four girls and two boys. Three boys. Four girls, three boys. And they are identified further by color of skin. Okay? So in the antediluvian period, Noah traveled the world to find these women, Yuma, Madevi, Kali, and Durga. He traveled the world. Remember, we think he's had 120 years to prepare for the ark. And during this time, he traveled the world. And Noah probably wasn't from Mesopotamia. That's where we don't even know where the ark was launched from, frankly. But we think it's there. So in this antediluvian, before the flood period, Noah traveled the world to find four representatives of four colors. He did this deliberately. So apparently counting after the 30 years, 10 years for each of the zones. This is what I said before. They made this circuitous layout. That's what we're going with this, all these people. So why did Noah take so long? I mean, why didn't he go to the village and pick out four women at random and said, good enough for me, let's go? Well, why did he not pick four women in the neighborhood rather than scour the earth for these particular women? Now, we have to guess a little bit why he did this. So a possible answer is that he was looking for the most representatives of the four colors. If he was to duplicate Adam's family of red, yellow, black, and white, which he was, again, maybe new thought for you, the races have to be blended, may have blended with few maintaining their original family distinction. So the general population would probably look somewhat the same color, at least not that you could say, well, now there's a red or there's a yellow, there's a black, and there's a white. So he probably went looking for these examples of these, I call them, oh, I hate to use this word, more pure in their line. You know, we get so terrible sense of race discussion these days, but you understand what I'm trying to say, I hope. Secondly, not only is there color, but there's also cheekbone locations. The lower the cheekbone you have, your face looks caved in. We think of the Orientals. So Noah himself was probably an Oriental yellow concave face. If you see that concave face in my drawing, all right. All right. So other colors, red, black, white, must come from other places. Or, you know, don't know where those places were. At least he had to go out looking for them. Then, not to exclude his yellow, because he only had three, so he's the fourth, he picked the needed fourth number for yellow. That would be for him. So everybody, all the women are represented by the colors. So a difficult search? Well, skin colors may have blended, and few continued their distinctive colors. So that's my conjecture, why it was so difficult, why it took him so long. So Noah's search may have been on various trips. How the women were taken to the ark is not said. At least not what I know of. It is not likely that they were slaves. They were taken as wives, or not in some kind of bondage. Did Noah preach repentance to these that he claimed? Possibly. And maybe that was the thing that made them distinct. Maybe these are ones that God, you know, we have this question about whether they're saved or not, but, you know, let's assume maybe they are or could be, that these are the ones that respond to the gospel and God would pick them out just like he picked out the animals, you know, for the next generations, that these women, he does it by election, you know, pick these out that Noah would find, and then these are the ones he brought back. So did Noah preach repentance on those that he claimed were counted with the faithful? But the animals obeyed. It is possible that the women obeyed in from the heart and agreed with the mission. This assumes an unannounced faith. And I don't know. We just are on thin ice here. Now, I just say this again, so you always are wondering. I know it's on your mind. Where do you get that from? Where do you get that from? Where do you get that from? All right. I'm not going to tell you where I get it from because I don't know where it comes from. But it's there. I mean, Pilkey says it's there. So that's what I told you in the beginning. We're going to have a guide here. Now, the guide may be wrong, and he's probably going to admit that he's wrong. I don't think Pilkey would admit he's wrong a lot, but so I know I'm telling you that somebody's got an answer for some of this stuff. I don't have it for you. And if you really want to dig into this stuff, I'm willing to dig it with you. So I just want to say that for you. And maybe next week I'll give you some examples of what they saw and why they thought that was important. All right. So I just want to say this because I'm off on a limb over here. And you're wondering, where's it going? Where's it going? Where's it going? How do you get that from? So I know where I'm not getting it from. All right. So we just have to trust our guide here. Okay. There's no reason these women could not have had children who died in the flood as others without faith. There's no reason that they could not have. We don't want to think of 60-year-old girls being picked out here. Remember, we have long long-lived judges, hundreds of years old people, and they still have children. I mean, so don't limit your thinking about this because, well, I mean, sure, they were 18-year-old girls and they, go on with the rest of it. Not necessarily. And there's some indication that some of these, at least one of them, might have had children, in other words, and there's reasons for that, which I don't know enough about to tell you about. But so there's some reason to think that possibly these women had children elsewhere from other men. You know, maybe they married somebody else. We don't know. But we know that if they had children, they either died or off early, or they were killed in the flood. So they were obviously unbelievers. So we have no record of their age or longevities of these women. We assume that they would parallel the men. They probably outlived the men. They do today, at least. Their childbearing years would be equally extended. It is possible they would have had many, and I might say many, many children by today's standard. So a family gathering may have looked more like a city gathering. You think about all the generations. You know, we're up to 30-something in our family, and I'm still living. I mean, in another generation, they're going to be up to 100. My wife's family, before her parents died, I think they were up to 100 already. So, you know, this goes kind of fast. Now, they had 9 children, so it helped. So longevities tend to make independent children. So, we don't want to think all these children come home with the mama all the time. After a while, they're pretty well independent people. You know, maybe they know who their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother was, but maybe they lose track. I just put this up to remind you how this works. And almost can't see what I'm doing here. Everything's so small. Here is Eber, the last of the Noahic family to live. And you see how his life extended way past a lot of his children. And this doesn't show it right, but Shem outlives Abraham. Noah does not live into Abraham's life. This chart is not using Filkey's dates. So that's why I say I've just brought it as an example. So you see the overhang of these long extended lives, and I didn't say it today yet, and I didn't have my notes, but remember, that's why these end up being called gods, because they live so long, and they seem to have so much wisdom, and they seem to be immortal. They never did die after hundreds of years. These guys down here died at 100 and maybe 150, and these guys lived to 600 years old. You can assign deity to them somehow, maybe with a small g, and of course we know all pagan mythology with him, whether it's the Greeks or the Romans, they picked up on these gods and renamed them. And we have Jupiter, we have Zeus. These are all names that come from these people in the Bible. They're not made up names out of the blue sky somewhere. Okay. So sometimes you wonder, well, who was Noah's wife? Well, depending on when you're asking. See, he had two wives, but Madavi would have been the one on the boat. Japheth's wife, and I go by color-coded here. So Japheth's wife was Kali, and Shem's wife was Durga, and Ham's wife was Uma. And you see the colors, what I'm trying to suggest there. So Noah selected these four females to approximate the original Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel. And I'll see if I can do this for you. Adam would have been black, Eve would have been white, Cain would have been yellow, and Abel would have been red. So the configuration of Adam's family, black, yellow, red, and red, and they were multilingual. They didn't just speak one language, which we've been told that they all spoke one language. Well, they spoke one language, but they were multilingual. They speak more than one language, but they had one language in common. And then especially when Ham comes along, he promotes his language and promotes it on everybody else, the Hamite language on everybody. That was the one language that they wanted the world to go by, and God said, no, you're not going to do that. That's when he shut them down. So they forgot what they call the primary language, and no one could speak to each other because the one language they had in common was forgotten. But they still had their own languages. I just thought on the side, you know, to dabble in other things, but it's interesting how languages develop. I mean, if you were, how would I do this? You'd have to have four people, let's say, or four families that know four different languages, and you were put on a rock somewhere or an island somewhere in the ocean, and you didn't know anything, but you were told three or four, five, six, seven, 10 things, you know, what water was and what the sky was and what food was and whatever. And you'd have these vocabularies. That's all you know amongst the four, your group's languages. How long would it take for you to develop language of your own? Not very long. In fact, with our advent of our coronavirus, we have, somebody said we have added, how many, were you telling me that? added all these new words to our vocabulary that weren't there before? Well, see, vocabulary comes because of need. And if there's no need, you don't make up words. But if you had a need for what is this piece of bread in our language, you'd probably come up with one pretty quick. So I'm just saying language is not all that mysterious. It develops. Even our kids can learn it. So the configuration of Adam's family, face construction. So Adam would have had he was black, had a concave face, and Eve would have had a convex case. Adam would have had a large body frame. Eve would have had a small body frame. And so these frames, not because she's a woman being small, but no, small for her, small for her group, whatever. And Adam was large for his group. So these are political wives. Think about that way more than any other way. They're political wives. These are what are, they're presented this way in public. This is who they are mated to in terms of a marriage, but that doesn't mean there aren't concubine wives elsewhere. So we did this loop around here, and don't want to do that again. That was last week. So this is how the first go around settlements were determined. We go around loop like this. Start from one on the top and to three. That's Canaan. We come across and Ham was cursed down here at what we call Yemen today. Crossed into Africa and back into the land. So those are 15 zoned. They weren't big enough to actually settle yet the first time around, but they were marked off. And it seems like that's what stayed. And either I've wondered if this is not the direction in the world somewhat they went, because seven is Kali's, and that's Iran. And she had that way back in the days of Japheth's war. By the way, Japheth is Chedorlaomer, or a little clue about that. And she was his wife, and she owned that piece, all right? So, and he came from Elam. Now, no, don't want to get too excited about where these people came from, because none of them ever stayed anywhere very long. They moved around a lot. This is one of my things I'm going to come up with later on to explain things. So this is how the first go-around settlements were determined. Well, it appeared that these settlements determined the later directions by expanding the whole world. I'm not sure if that's true, but it's possible. I didn't stop to think about it or study it. Now here I mentioned about Japheth's wife, Kali, maintains possession of Elam, which is Iran. She's number seven on our list at the time of the Abrahamic War. She still owns that. She still has claims to that, or still considered hers, or still considered Elam. So in order to understand things, is to help to list the rules for the culture. They are different from ours. We already should understand. They had a smaller view of God than we do. Maybe that's not even the right word. Inadequate, maybe not the right word either. They had little revelation compared to ours. That's obvious. We have the scriptures. They didn't have that. Moses didn't put anything together until Exodus. So we must give them the freedom to act as they did without moralistic judgment of a time and economy that we know little about. And I say that's why we study this stuff. So a couple of points here. Recognize the absolute authority of Noah that he yields on his family. At least that's how it starts. Later there will be a council of the elites, 54 members out of the 70 that I mentioned before. Those are the ones that are going to run. That's why they're in the Bible, I think. They're the ones that ran the show. But now in the early trial run at settlement, Noah's word is the law. There is family-wide support of Noah's endeavor. It's for sure up till we get to Yemen. This family functions together and recognizes the curses and blessings on Ham and obeyed orders, although weren't happy with it. 2a, the highest value recognized by these people, known by their linguistic stock, which was their genetic markers, the what they spoke. I told you last week, there's nothing more binding to a culture than the language they speak. It doesn't matter what race they are, what color they are, or economic status they are. Language is what ties people together. I remember when we grew up around our Hamilton County that we were German-speaking people, and they were different. We were different than the English-speaking people. In fact, we had words for the English, and they had words for us. And there was a divide because these were the Lutherans and there's the Mennonites. And that line you could see was, you know, by our field. So these linguistic things are really important. And we'd sort of lose track of that because we lived in a melting pot where we only learned one language. This is really sad. We should know more. So these people are identified with the genetic family, the stock, more importantly by their language. The women came from the world, no doubt, brought their languages with them, and their children would have carried on with multiple languages, up to eight right there, we could say. And maybe they were more, everybody seemed to be multilingual except those that are in the United States. Go to Europe, a lot of people speak two or three languages. Point 2b, therefore, linguistic stock would be a unified group as a family with racial differences accompany the linguistic groups. Their language identifies the, identified by, the eight names of the God they serve. Ham was the Elohimist, but Noah took that from him and gave it to Shem. And Shem, remember he's Melchizedek, Shem claimed it in the blessing of Abraham. And Abraham adds Yahweh to it. So Elohim, Yahweh. So in this, that's what Abraham has then as his, quote, God. In the curse, the linguistic stock, became tradable. Now that's also another concept we don't get. And I had a hard time, have a hard time with this yet. So I think the resolve of this is that the stock were tradable, but they didn't necessarily move. And the diplomatic control was by someone else, but they no longer did they belong to Ham, but now they belong to Japheth. And they no longer belong to Japheth, they belong to Shem. So when I say they're tradable, I'm not sure exactly how it worked out, but they knew what that meant. And they were so tradable that the Japhethites that went to Ham were there long enough that they no longer had their identification of Japhethites because they were called Hamites in the Bible. But you can understand why you'd say why that would happen. So they're tradable. Were they slaves? Well, the American Standard has the word servant, but the word is slaves. I don't get hung up on the word. No one should, but we do. So point three, baked into the system from the first is the absolute necessary of for order and unity to accomplish the assignments. Now, I'm supposing the reason that is so important was because they remember the chaos of the antediluvian period. They were not going to repeat that again. At least that was Noah's intent. Even the cursing and the blessing of Noah followed the Hamite sin was accepted and honored to an extent. Yet the resentment that it fostered will raise its ugly head in the Tower of Babel incident 88 years later. Discord by the very descendants of the offended Ham family who will lead the way to the rebellion so much for unity and harmony. And it seemed like I said, that's where the fracture started, and it never got healed. So the permanent fracture occurs with the Uruk and Urata war, which is what I told you before. I do not understand that war, but it splits the world in two, which is what Peleg says in his days when the war was divided. So the temporary rule of the Noahic elite, they rule as if by contract. There's another thing that is different. It seemed like there were the 30-year intervals that they ruled different places, like as if it was musical chairs. You know, Ham ruled 30 years here, then he moved over here, he used 30 years, so it's almost like they moved around. And it seems like they rotate them without cause or comment, like as if there was something agreed to by the elite 54. That's how we're going to do it. Now, maybe what'll help here is that these kingships were nations that were built from the top down. The opposite of democracy, where democracy comes from the bottom up. The people decide who the leader would be. In this case, the leader is given to the people. And the people live under the leadership. The leadership can change. So you almost can say leadership by contract or by agreement. And so it's almost like, well, he was our ruler 30 years ago, but now, remember, we have hundreds of years here. He was our leader 30 years ago and 60 years ago and then 10 years ago, and you name these leaders that you've had. But apparently they've been signed to these groups, and I don't understand that because we don't think that way at all. But that apparently is how it was. So the opposite of democracy, which is from the bottom up, the people chose their leader. Here the leader is chosen and the people are gathered. So that is the kingships that come down from heaven. So God imposes the kingship on heaven, from heaven. He's the source of the authority. Okay, finally we got to get to this. The most difficult of all the rules of engagement are the moral ethics practiced by Noah. However, Pilgi says this, until the demands of this task are weighed and measured, I repeat this more than once, until they are weighed and measured, we are in no position to judge their moral lives, marital or otherwise. And until we seriously consider the implication of their high longevities, we have no idea what we're trying to judge. So in a way, he says, keep your noses out of the question. Hard to do, Pilgi. So I'm going to use his book, and I'm going to quote from him what he says about this period. So I think I already gave you these wives of the Noah. Okay, that's, you know, it's interesting, but doesn't make any difference who they are. So Pilkey says, any reader of the New Testament realizes that marital irregularities existed on a large scale in ancient times. And we said, amen. I didn't hear you say that, but I'm sure you did. It would be rather strange if Noah, father of the Gentiles, had practiced a higher standard of marital ethics than polygamous Abraham, ancestor to Israelites, or polygamous David and Solomon, leading kings of Israel. You're going to hold those guys to a higher standard than those guys? More important, a certain degree of marital irregularity by our standards is built into the scheme of origins. Adam and Eve could generate a world community only through sibling incest among their children. To all appearances, Noah and his three sons were monogamous. Why else would the survivors of the flood be confined to eight persons? I don't know what he means with that. I suppose he means you could have taken more. It is quite clear that each of the four females who survived the flood was reckoned the political wife of one and only one of the four surviving males. There's no question about who the wife was. But older they may be one at a time. With that Noah, she had two. He didn't have two on the flood. He had one before the flood and one for the flood and never had another one after that. So the principle of monogamy was well established in some code of behavior. We always say that Genesis said from the beginning that God created him and so forth. We know all that. Yet we can be equally certain that the code also included various degrees of sibling incest and along with it a pattern of polygamous concubinage rooted in eugenic, which is selective mating for resultant offspring planning. And that's what we have here. They did something deliberately to have certain kind of offspring. We're looking at red, yellow, black, and white. That's the eugenic planning. If each of the four Noahic couples had practiced strict lifelong monogamy, each would have duplicated the function of Adam and Eve in establishing their own separate version of the human race. So we'd have four different human races. Only four. Four racial stocks of mankind would have to be traced back to the four surviving males, as though Noah and his three sons were radically different, and they were not. Furthermore, we would expect to find a central type of each color group, a single true black, a true red, a true yellow, and a true white. Such is not the case. Actually, there are not three, there's actually four. You know, three boys, four races. The Darvidian from India, blacks of India represented a distinct type of blacks of distinct from the blacks of Africa, just as the true but racially different. The whites of Europe have been distinguished into Nordic, North, Alpine, Central, Mediterranean, East types, and the Amerindians, we know about them, display a characteristic red type in the South and Central America and a Mongoloid type in the North. I remember when the guy was here from missions, the Girls of Grace had him, and he was a missionary to Russia, to these people in East Russia, and he showed us these pictures, and I said, those people look like they're from Mexico. Mongoloids. See, all of a sudden we don't know where the people are. All right, so I'm trying to make a point. So I don't know if this is important, but we have Noah, yellow. His first wife is Yuma, and she's just replaced by Davidi, didn't die. And now here, get this, Yuma becomes the wife of Ham. Now see, this is where the stuff really gets really upsetting for us. But let's just say it as it is. And then we have Kali and Japheth and Shem and Durga as the way it pairs up. So I say, Noah and three boys would generate only three families, is what Pilkey said, but then there are many more shades of color than that. This cannot be explained by mutual process of mixing. And that's what we say, well, they all got mixed up. Well, people groups pretty well maintain their kind. Of course, there are exceptions in mixing people of their choices. I said we had a person with us to our trip to Poland that she was from America, and he was from Japan. I said, well, that's probably not the trend. You know, maybe they're in this and that. But you know, in terms of, well, that's where it's all going. Everybody's going to, the Japanese and the whites, are whatever they're called, are going to meld together. We'll have something. No, it's probably not going to happen. So we just don't have that happen naturally. So there has to be a better reason for it. So the America, by the way, America is an unusual place for all kinds of reasons. But America is a melting pot because we're not a nation of immigrants. That's an old word. We're Americans, but our forebearers were immigrants, and probably every one of you here, that's true. Would you like to challenge that statement? I don't know. I guess if you're American Indian, you could challenge it, but we're all from somewhere else. So it's this melting pot where differences are accepted. And that's why America is just doesn't fit the pattern at all. That's why maybe sometimes it's called exceptional, because it is exceptional. But today, this melting pot, which is supposed to be the dream of the left, is being exploited by the enemy through critical race theory. So they pits one of us against the other and demand unity, but they insist diversity. Which is it? This, I'm off the track. So they want unity for obedience, but diversity to weaken us. So that's America. So America doesn't really fit this pattern, although America is also popularized by the Noahic family. Next week. So if you look, the simplest and best explanation is that these radical diversities within each color group derived from a process of ethnic deliberate planning via polygamy within Noah's immediate family. Because all four males closely related, they could not have displayed enough variation to account for the distinctly colored groups by the close of the third millennium. And the altruism of history is that feudalism, which is what we're going to see in the models, feudalism results in the forced match, political marriage, adulterous courtly love, and other marital irregularities. And you look in Europe and you see this all the time, medieval Europe. Noah's family was the quintessence, most perfect and typical example of feudalism. Noah's family was the most typical example of feudalism, with the king and everybody that serves him. This task was to divide the post-millennial, post-diluvian world into theocratic, remember, that eight fiefs, bind one ruler to another through vassalage, you know, this ownership of each other's linguistic stock, or political sonship. You're not a son of mine, but I'm going to call you my son, so you're of record my son. And reign through the archaic principles of tribal dynasty over peoples formed from their own progeny. I don't understand that, but it's a mix-up. That's what I understand. Remember, feudal Europe, 9th to the 15th century, is defined as a set of reciprocal legal military obligations which existed among the warrior nobility and revolved around the three concepts of lord, vassals, and fiefs. That's actually what we have going on with Noah's family. They're kings in these small groups, smaller groups. Okay, so here I repeat this again, just in case we forget this. Until demands of this age, repopulation of the earth, are weighed and measured, we have no position to judge their moral lives, marital or otherwise, and until we seriously consider all the implications of their high longevities, we have no idea of what we're trying to judge. So the high longevities of Noah's immediate family combined with the Gentile, he called it Pentecost, you know, he's come down from heaven, of human government to make the family the most astounding aristocracy the world's ever known. According to Genesis 11:11, Shem lived 502 years after the flood, roughly the second half of the third millennium. That's how long he lived. So Pilkey, it reiterates that Noah was given a mandate to repopulate the earth in an organized way. The mandate directs that the families, the races, of the original population be preserved and expanded, each with territories for growth as Gentile nations of the earth. This idea is completed in various phases, including the Americas. That's what I'll do for you next week. Okay, what do we have time here? So Pilkey's comment is repeated here. Yet we can be equally certain that the code also included various degrees of sibling incest, and along with it, a pattern of polygamous concubinage rooted in eugenic planning. Pilkey makes this comment based on necessity and historical evidence, again from above. If each of the four Noahic couples had practiced strict monogamy, each would have duplicated the function of Adam and Eve in establishing their own separate version of the human race, and we wouldn't have the blending. So four racial stocks of mankind would have to be traced back to the four surviving males, as through Noah, and his three sons were all racially, as if they were all racially diverse, and they weren't. Furthermore, we could expect to find a central type of each color group, a single true black, a single red, and so forth. We expect that then, but we didn't have that. In other words, there would be only four skin colors, not the many varieties. Of course, these four colors would have mixed over time, and we've had them as we see them today. I'm kind of repeat myself here. However, the diversity is from the generation of the immediate post-flood population. He suggests that we observe that black skin can be African or Asian, Indian, and others. And I remember the first time I saw that, I said, that was really strange to me. somewhat explained here. Now, I took from Walt Brown's book this picture, which I think is kind of a neat picture. He says, a few members of the human race have followed from the falling places. I'll read them off and you watch as I go through this. The top left to right from the top, Japan, Tibet, Borneo, Holland. Second row, Ireland, China, Rwanda, Korea. Third row, New Zealand, Bali, Okinawa, Israel. Fourth row, United States, Austria, India, Egypt. Bottom row, Molucca Islands, I don't know that one, Canada, Greece, and Guatemala. And see, we have very, very many variations, not red, yellow, black, and white. And this is what Noah's going to actually produce, because that's pictures of people that are produced by Noah's plan. Okay, this necessitates explanation, which Pilkey does in the use of the term incest. Here we must guard against backloading the word with its use as of today's interfamily sexual activity. Justification is that siblings in Adam and Eve had children without the charge of incest. The polygamy of the patriarchs Abraham, Jacob, and even the beloved David had multiple wives and concubinage children. Perhaps the clearest God-directed incest in the Bible is in the case of Onan. Now, you want to read this sometime, you might. It's kind of an interesting story. Genesis 38:9, where Onan was ordered by God in the law, that in the case of a husband's death, his brother had to sire an heir for him through his widow. Onan refused, not in religious indignation or moral indignation, but in selfishness, knowing his own estate would be diminished. All right, so he's ordered to do this. Now, Onan probably had a wife sitting over here. What are you doing going off with that woman? God told me to do it. Really? Yes, God told me to. It's in the law, prescribed in the law. So this is an example of higher principle, as when the restrictions of Sabbath work are set aside, or as when an ox fell into the well. Sabbath rules are set aside, higher principle. Every miracle sets aside the unbending law. Unbending laws of God, by the way. Have you noticed that? Every time you fall down, you always go down. The laws of nature, of gravity, are always the same. Unless, every miracle sets aside the unbending laws of God and nature for the purpose of showing God's sovereign authority over the laws. So, when Jesus walks on the water, or turns water at Cana into wine, Moses opened the sea for dry land crossing, we have a few examples of God overruling his laws for his purposes. So our question then about incest of family members can be understood as serving a higher principle and thus not sinful. That is, if God intended the earth to be repopulated with a variety of races, he accomplished it in the children born to the women with a variety of skin colors by Noah. All primary settlers were Noah's family, including the seven children. They're all fathered by Noah. So a truism of history that feudalism results in force-matched political marriage, adulterous courtly love, and other marital irregularities. Noah's family was quintessence, the most perfect and typical example of feudalism. So this task was to divide the post-diluvian world into theocratic fiefs, bind one ruler to another through vassalage or political sonship. That was what he's supposed to do. That's the rule. That's the higher cause. And reign through the archaic principle of tribal dynasty over people formed from their own progeny. Remember, I'm not going to read that again. I read it twice already. So God's way. Perhaps these works of God seem out of character. After all, we are taught that in the morality and family life, there is to be one man, one woman in the marriage relationship, and deviation from this standard is a violation of God's directives. Well, we have Matthew 19. Give us that. Have you not read? He created them from the beginning. See, there we go. Back to the beginning. Made them male and female. He said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. We have it in the Bible, even in Matthew. So how can God, who is the same yesterday and today forever, require these different standards? As cited earlier, the historical uses of reproduction for the human family occasionally fell outside the limits of the one man and one woman relationship by design. So there are higher principles at work when God sets aside his law and will not enforce it. This is evident in the incident with Onan. The necessity to raise up an heir for his brother's family ranked as a higher principle to control Onan than for Onan be faithful to his wife and deny his brother an heir. At other times, this act would be an unfaithful act, But here it is an unfaithful act if Onan refused. Just the opposite. Well, this is the consolation verse prize for everybody. If we really get stuck on this, there's always some verse you want to go to when you're really in trouble. These are some of them. For one example, the secret things belong to the Lord God, but the things revealed belong to us and to our sons forever. So we focus here on the secret things. I don't understand this, Lord. I don't understand this. Well, maybe it belongs something that belongs only to God. And then we have Deuteronomy, that was 29:29. Then Deuteronomy 32:4 says, the rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are just. So whatever God does is just. The God of faithfulness and without injustice, righteous and upright is he. So whatever he does is right, even though I don't understand it. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor my ways your ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your ways, or his thoughts. So, and if it was not his direct will, he permitted it, approved it in his sovereign will. In any case, we have the people, population we see on earth today. Now, I don't like to quote other people particularly, but Mark Twain has a good one. I've heard other people use it. And it has this real added, a real thing that I think is really important when we look at other people. And in my limited amount of travel we've done, I think this is really true. It really helped. Because you tend to think, I tend to think how life is where I live and the people I lived grew up with. And there's a whole other world out there I've never met. And because of that, I look at them with some suspicion. You know, we do that naturally. So Mark Twain's comment was, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And many of the people need it sorely on these accounts. I've heard you guys use that new travel work. And I think that's probably true. Now, I don't want to leave you with the Mark Twain quote, but it is a good one. And we have leave you one with from Peter's Paul's sermon in Athens, where he was preaching to the nations, where he says he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth. Now, we could talk about Adam, or we could also talk about Noah there. Having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their inhabitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. All right, so next week we'll cover the earth with humanity, and we'll talk about the shift at the Abrahamic War.